Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, producer Jonah Primo here, and welcome to Principle of Charity, where we inject curiosity and generosity back into our conversations on big social issues. Now, this is part two on whether or not we should embrace shame. The On the Couch episodes are Lloyd's unfiltered approach to the principle of charity. And in part one, Emil really teases out the topic with the guests. If you missed that, I really encourage you to press pause, go back, and have a listen, as it will contextualize some of the conversation you're about to hear. For everyone else, we have Patty Ashley and Tanvir Ahmed on the couch. Enjoy.
Tanvir and Patty, thank you so much. There was a great conversation with Emil. What we always do in the principle of charity is try to ensure that we try and incorporate the other perspective. And so we encourage both ourselves to get out of our thinking bubble, to try and be curious about the other side. And so, Tanvir, I'm going to start with you. What are the three downsides to shame rather than the upside, bearing in mind you've written on the defense of shame?
There's certainly poor ways of shaming. And, you know, Patty's alluded to them. And the poor ways were, yeah, where you kind of destroy someone's dignity when it flows into the kind of, I guess, the notion of humiliation, where there's no path back to any sort of group identity, and where people think, yes, I'm a bad person, and they retreat. Where it leads to just pure retreat, that's another version of kind of negative versions of shame. And they're all the bad ways we can shame.
Great. Patty, you mentioned to Emil that shame is never okay. So let's, again, taking the principle of charity, what are the three benefits of shame, if you had to look at the other side of your argument?
Well, again, the difference between shame and shaming, and I think shame itself is a regulatory emotion. If I feel really bad because I've hurt someone, it helps me self-correct, course-correct. That's definitely the primal benefit of shame. But I think we've taken it so far into a culture that wants to control other people by shaming them that we've gone almost in the shadow side of shame, in a sense, you know, a Jungian term of this unconscious shaming in order to control others. But shame itself, yeah, is a regulatory emotion.
So that would be one benefit. What would be another benefit?
I don't think it's ever okay.
You don't.
I can't do it. Like I said, the only thing I can see is that one thing is it's a regulatory emotion that helps us course correct, especially if we have good guidance around us that then gives us the direction of how we're going to course correct, but not to shame somebody who's feeling shame or who's done something inappropriate. I don't think there's ever a benefit to that.
And a question to both of you, but I'll start with you, Patty, then. How do I hold people accountable without shaming them?
Well, there's consequences for our behavior, you know, and what's the consequence of that behavior? And how, I think it's really important to follow through. I'm not a permissive parent advocate at all. Let the kids be kids. No, there's boundaries and there's consequences for our behavior, but they don't have to be punitive shaming. They can be, you know, leave your bike outside, it gets stolen. I'm not going to buy you another bike. I'm sorry that happened. And you'll have to figure out a way to save the money to buy another bike, but I'm not going to shame you for it and then go buy you another bike. You see the difference? And parents.
Yeah. So what you're really saying is there's a behavioral consequence and rather than you are a bad person for leaving your bike outside.
Exactly.
Tanvir, getting to you, What's your view from a social or political point of view about how we hold people accountable rather than shame them?
I agree with Emil to a large extent. Like our systems of justice, etc. I think you know are extremely advanced, and it's a big part of the success of countries like ours or the Anglo-European sort of system. So I'm not necessarily saying we would need to run away from that. I guess my broader thing is the existence of shame tells us a lot about some of the challenges of modern life. And they allude to, one, the place of the primitive and how we arguably suppress that too much in the culture, you know, and many of the problems I see are linked to that. The other is the place of a moral language. So, for example, a lot of patients I see, it's really about where we increasingly don't have a language for suffering or adversity, and increasingly we get a more medicalized version of it. And that can be quite limiting. You know, a classic one is, say, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, we've seen sort of a tripling or quadrupling of diagnosis in many Western countries, Britain and Australia, and I suspect in the US as well. And while, you know, a great deal of that is to do with awareness, you know, perfectly legitimate. I mean, many patients I see, it's in part because they barely have a language, just the old religious language. Why do bad things happen to good people? You know, many of what is diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder overlaps with that. So that's another reason shame is so important to discuss and identify and talk at a deeper level, because it really illuminates all these deeper aspects of ourselves, why we have primitive aspects that we're losing a language for. We have moral aspects and we need a richer language to describe our experience and our pathology than we sometimes have. And we have yearnings for groups. Yes, we have these great systems around law and justice and citizenry, but we still have these deep yearnings for groups. And they come out in very unusual ways now in the way we live now, especially with the online world. And the better we understand that and understand modern notions of shame, the better we can help people and encourage human flourishing and have better societies in a way.
Okay. So let's take a practical example. There is a man who beats up his wife regularly, and he's beaten up his wife substantively over 15, 20 years, to the point where she's psychologically helpless, physically at risk. The judge sentences this individual to a period of imprisonment and says, when you get out, or for a period of time, you're going to have to wear a sign saying, I'm a wife beater. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because, again, what are our groups now? So it may have been a tribal setting where there's a reintegration component. It's tougher in our society because we are sort of anonymous people just wandering around. And what groups are we actually directly connected to? Say you're in a tribe and say there was a set period where you had to do that for a couple of weeks and then there was some other ritual to reintegrate you, then that may be a useful thing, right? But the way you've described that one, I'm just trying to think what their path back to reintegration is.
Well, they wear the sign for a year.
Yeah. It's possible, but does that stain them for the rest of their lives in the modern world? I'm not sure they can be reintegrated after something like that. You know, there'll be images of them forever. It becomes a permanent stain. So it becomes a lot tougher. But what I would say about their punishment more generally is there should be an individual punishment, a legal public punishment, but part of regulating the behavior, there may be a group component. Like what are the groups this person is connected to? You know, is there a footy team they play for and are the men there, you know, potentially able to regulate this man's behavior, you know, by how they might ostracize him or treat him or then give him a path back. So there's a legalistic way, but there's also a form of social regulation that can be healthy. But the reality is many people in our society aren't necessarily connected to groups. You know, and this person may be along those lines. So where somebody isn't formally connected to groups, you'll find even though people aren't formally connected to groups, they will still be connected in their minds to imagined groups. So they still may behave in some way to an imagined group. So that'd be interesting to assess. But the bigger point is, yeah, you can shame, but there needs to be a path to reintegration. But maybe that's really hard in today's world when you get a permanent mark. Now, that could be a Google link, that could be a picture, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that makes it that makes it much tougher.
Patty, how about you? Should this person have to wear the sign or not? I'm a wife beater.
You can only imagine the cringing going on inside me right now with that question. Absolutely not. So I would say let's rehabilitate, because the wife beating comes from this person's shame. So the work, this is the problem with our justice system, is we don't rehabilitate the reasons behind these bad choices these people make. We shame them more. So we're never going to make progress that way. I totally don't see it at all. So ideally, in an ideal world, which again, I'm talking about constructing something that's never been done before, that criminal would have to really face his own shame after getting out. Then what about restorative justice? How can I give back to the community? What can I do for women and, you know, helping domestic violence change? See, so I'm doing something productive. I'm writing that new story. I've learned that, a lot of my behavior came from that. I didn't feel worthy of love and belonging. So I'm going to beat my wife in order to, because that's just something I've developed over time. Wearing a sign saying that to me is the absolute antithesis of what I think would be productive.
Even though, of course, it may benefit many other women. If all men believed that if they abused women, they would have to wear the sign for a year, they may be more careful about abusing other women. And so from a utility point of view, there may be substantive upside to women.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
So, Lloyd, can I come in there? Look, for all our debates about shame, the reality is one of the great successes of the Western world is that we place so much value in the dignity of the individual. But that really is a cornerstone. So regardless of whether you're a murderer or you're the prime minister, whoever you are, that is a real cornerstone of our culture. So in no way do either of us, and certainly not me, suggesting that that should be diminished. Now, the broader argument around shame is that we elevate the individual appropriately in our culture, and that's a big part of our success. But there's all these aspects of ourselves that yearn for groups, that have innate needs and for group identity. And that's an aspect of ourselves that is not easily dealt with in our culture.
Let me ask both of you this question. And I experience shame. So there are times when I just feel like I'm a bad person. There are times when I definitely feel guilt. I feel that I've done something wrong. And there are probably times, using the Brené Brown definition of humiliation, when I feel people have said that I'm bad, but I'm not. So it feels, I feel humiliated. If I came to each one of you and I said, or to both of you, and I said, look, Tanveer, Paddy, tell me how I move from shame to guilt, what would your approach be?
Well, look, like any sort of analysis, if you like, I mean, first you're trying to understand their experience. You know, who they are, what does the notion of shame mean? How does that then play out in their thought patterns, who they think they are, and day-to-day behavior? And that's when you can start sort of challenging it, because almost certainly it'll be linked to erroneous beliefs or what we call cognitive distortions. And even as part of that, you're also trying to develop a trusting relationship with this person. So part of therapy is first just, again, acknowledge the innate worth of anyone. Now, for example, you know, I have to see pedophiles sometimes in jails and write reports. You know, even in that setting, you know, I have to sort of acknowledge their innate worth. So there is a almost a religious Christian component to that, even though I'm not formally religious. Yeah. So I think that's part of any treatment, whether it's, you know, psychology or any sort of, you know, health professional, if you like. So it has to begin there. And then from there, that place of a kind of a love is where you tease out the meanings of this. And almost all patients, you'll find they will start seeing a greater depth to how they attribute some of these terms and how they attribute the meaning to themselves and their relationship with others. Yeah. And that's really the place of analysis. But I guess one of my roles is, you know, we see people as individuals and that can have limitations. So sometimes you need group rituals too. And that's partly where this shame discussion comes. So,
So that's the group work that you were referring to with Emil earlier.
Yeah, they can't. Yeah, okay. Many of the people I see, they can't really get healing without some sort of group ritual. You know, that could be through their religious group or whatever social group, whatever it might be. And that's the limitation of sometimes that my treatment has.
And it's real for me. Esther, I've already got sort of two benefits from Tanvir's statement around myself. I probably got a whole batch of cognitive distortions and imagined groups that I'm worried about that results to my shame. Patty, how would you get me from shame to guilt?
Well, most of my clients don't even know that they have shame. They come more in with the guilt, or again, it's the language. So I don't even use the word shame with my clients until I've really established whether or not that's going to be a trigger for the core shame. But if they came to me and said that, I've already got an idea that they understand shame to some degree. And I would simply point out the difference like I did earlier. Guilt is I did something bad. Shame is I am bad. So I'd love to help you tease out what this core belief that I am bad's about so we can, you know, repair whatever you feel guilty about and not internalize it so much.
Yeah, that's great. Let me come to putting both of you on the couch about your own shame. What are the areas where you feel a sense of shame? Patty, I'll start with you.
Okay. I got a whole list. How much time do you have, Lloyd?
probably not time for a therapy session, but go for it if you could give us the headline.
Let me give you the bullet points. I was raised Catholic, very shaming, you know, very punitive. You should be ashamed, shame, shame. My father died when I was 11 of a sudden heart attack and nobody wanted to talk to me about it. And so I had all kinds of feelings and I felt a lot of shame because I had feelings I didn't understand and nobody wanted to talk to me. There's something wrong with me. So I decided I wanted to be a therapist and, you know, give people a place to talk about things they didn't want to talk about. But I end up barely making it through college, getting pregnant, getting married because I'm Catholic, having lots of babies because I'm Catholic, and then started therapy when I was 30 and was like, oh my gosh, what have I done? Get divorced, move across the country as a parent educator, shame, 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 shame. Oh my gosh. You know, dealing with this deep core shame my whole entire life is why I'm so passionate about this work, because it's not anything I did. It's this idea that I'm bad, and boy, all of these things that happen to me that society deems bad reinforce the idea that I am.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's hard to pull out of that shame spiral. Mm. I could go on, but I'll just stop with that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I'd like to come back to some of that. That's incredibly helpful. Tanvir, how about you? Where's your area of shame?
Look, both sort of public and private. So, you know, privately, obviously, you know, there's all these ways you can be a better person, be a better father, be a husband, and how you might have mistreated people in the past. And, you know, all those things play out. But I guess I certainly have an interesting dimension because, you know, I'm in public area. It's often a classic one. And Emil alluded to this with cancel culture. I definitely feel like arguably I've been falsely shamed sometimes where you write something, it's misrepresented, but that's the part that gets magnified, you know, whether it's social media, Google links, et cetera. And that certainly happened to me in the past regarding things I've written in the press, et cetera. And I feel like it's been misrepresented. And then I've essentially been shamed because of that. You know, I've also been accused of sort of journalistic misdemeanors. And similar, you sort of get, you know, these things, I'm probably an example that's felt the digital shame where, you know, there'll be some sort of Google link and you sort of feel like it's not entirely representative of what happened or what you said. But that leaves a kind of long-term mark and it's almost, it keeps coming back. That's what I find. That's what's challenging about this debate. We want to reintegrate people.
Yeah.
But the modern online world actually can make that quite difficult. And that's why I'm fascinated by some of these debates, say, for example, the EU, where they wanted to bring in a law, the right to be forgotten, you know, where you might have had some sort of Google link from a decade ago, but you should have the right for that to be almost wiped from your plate. So I find that a very interesting way of thinking about this, that there's a modern version of digital shame that can limit reintegration.
Yeah. And That's really interesting. I mean, I assume, you know, because it's in the public domain and if you're not comfortable to talk about it, we won't. But this was sort of an allegation of your plagiarism. Is that right?
Yeah, that's only one of them. But yeah, also in the past where I've written, column. I remember when I had a domestic violence column where I was alluding to changes in male lives. And to some extent, I was even talking about my father there, the challenges he had in migrating and rapid changes in women's roles and changes in the economy. So that was another one where I was heavily shamed, kind of for almost essentially being accused of making excuses for domestic violence. And I thought that was a huge misrepresentation. But, you know, those, and even if it isn't, they stick, you know, for example, where with accusations of plagiarism, and how, they sort of stick and, you know, they're in the, and while I've recovered, there's still a Google link. So sometimes it'll come up in the strangest of circumstances, even though it's from a decade ago, a long time ago.
And how have you dealt with that? Because there's so much material on people who, you know, have suffered public shaming on social media and just the mental health impact that it has on them and the, at times, the unforgiving nature of it. It can, as you say, last for decades. How did you personally, and how are you currently managing it? What do you say to yourself that helps you manage?
Look, I think you just have to carry on. The reality is, you know, my foundations are strong. You know, I'm a psychiatrist and that side has been solid along. So there's a public component that I think, look, the way I think of it is this. If you're in the public, you need to think of that almost as a mining stock or like kind of a tech stock. You know, it's up and down. There's a lot more risk.
It's a growth stock. It's a growth stock.
There's a lot more risk, right? And that's kind of the way I integrate it, that there's a lot more risk in those sort of behaviors. Now, look, it can affect your family and others who aren't as used to the public domain. But I think I've been able to integrate it going, okay, look, this isn't, not unlike what Paddy was saying, you know, things that happen in public life or you've made errors in a public life. So in that respect, Paddy is correct. You can't incorporate this as I'm a bad person. And there are these unique aspects of being in the public lens that you almost just, it just comes with the domain. And I think anyone involved, you know, even in small ways in public commentary or any sort of public work has to accept those risks that they may be misrepresented, that that gets magnified through that lens. And you almost have to just get on and keep doing good work and, you know, not let it get you down.
But why is there the psychology of unforgiveness? I mean, because I don't think that's just a Western issue. I mean, it's in all the shaming cultures have it, that you are not forgiven. What goes on why we don't forgive? There must be massive psychological benefit to not forgiving. What are they?
Well, sometimes it's straight out self-interest. You know, here's someone, you know, who's not a competitor or they're not doing this, et cetera. So there's a component of that. Sometimes it's a straight out rage. And I do think it's more that we get into this habit of good or bad. So if there's someone we don't actually know, almost most people we know individually, we will see them in greater complexity, right? But in public life, where we see cartoonish components of people, I think we're far more likely to go, okay, you're good or bad. And that's when it's easier for us to completely ostracize or cancel someone or get rid of someone, where in our minds we can very much say, oh, they're the other or they're evil. And I think there is a bit more of that going on these days.
Do you think if we had just sort of got back to talking less, and I'm sure Patty will have very different views on this, but talking less about trauma, talking less about worrying about trauma, and just got on with that sort of old-fashioned dimension of get on with it, that we would worry less about shame?
Oh, look, I think that would be simplistic. I think it's appropriate that we have a deeper language for our suffering. But I do think the culture, to some extent, the modern culture almost sees people as fundamentally vulnerable, whereas I think for most of human history, we've seen people as resilient. And this also overlaps with some of Emile's comments about being so sensitive to emotional harm, particularly for groups that we might see as vulnerable in some way. So that's the key thing I would say, that we need to be careful not to construct the human being as innately vulnerable when in fact we are innately resilient.
We often talk in our show about the subculture of the particular discipline, and in your case, psychiatry. When do you think psychiatry should be more shamed? I mean, it seems to me, let me preface that as with therapy, psychology, even general practice in medicine, there isn't a great feedback loop from patients. And I sometimes feel that the professions, in this case, sometimes medicine, psychology, psychiatry, are not very charitable to patients in getting their feedback about how this therapy is progressing. I mean, people have been in therapy for 7 years. They don't go, you know what, let's review how this therapy is going. And the discipline should be allowing the patient to give some feedback. And in not allowing the patient to give feedback, it's not very charitable. So I'm asking you, in psychiatry, when is the profession needing to get more charitable with patients to get more feedback from them?
Look, absolutely. I totally agree with you, Lord, there. I think psychiatry should be much more honest with itself. There's so much we don't know. You know, our diagnoses are quite grey. We've become too dependent on drugs. And we should go back to basics and help people understand their experience. And there is a big movement around this. And just be very modest about our knowledge and how we can intervene, and that ultimately it's our patients that help themselves, and we're kind of facilitators in that. And look, I think most good psychiatrists are that way inclined, but sometimes the public, the way we project ourselves publicly is not accurate to how much we actually understand of the brain and of mental illness. So I think we've oversold some of our abilities and our knowledge.
And as a result, you will probably get a whole batch of criticism because you've oversold.
And appropriately so.
Get ready for some more shaming. Paddy, in a similar vein to my question to Tanvir, when we look at the discipline of psychotherapy, what are the feedback loops that therapists are getting that help them understand whether they are actually benefiting the client or not?
Well, there aren't any, and I agree with you. There ought to be some way for therapists to get that sort of feedback. I think a good therapist wants that. And again, my shame-informed therapy is all about that. It's relational, and it's about balancing power so the therapist isn't knowing, all-knowing, and the client is just the client who needs help. It's that relation where we're open for feedback, and we ask, you know, how are you feeling today? How am I? We can even say, how am I doing? Mm. You know, and I think it's really when we balance out that power and get out of the position of thinking that we know more and we're better than that organically happens. Mm. That's what good therapy is, in my opinion.
I'd like to come back to your experience of shame and you know, your openness about it, and just staying again with the vein of treatment. You know, you've looked at yourself, you're working in the domain of shame. What stops you? Why does this still continue with yourself despite all your work? Why is shame still there for you despite, I assume, you've been in psychotherapy, you work on it? Why does it linger so much?
I'm just aware of it, and I have tools, and I do what I need to do to refocus myself and regulate. Most people don't know how to do that because it's all unconscious. So they act out in certain ways that are really coming from this core shame, and they just keep repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating. For me, I'm shameless in terms of I know I have shame. And that's one thing. That's the other thing my clients love about me is, wow, you say that. You? Wow. You know, and it's, again, it's that twinning. It's that taking me down off the pedestal and making me human. We're all in this together. We're trying to figure out an awful lot right now regarding the human condition. And so, yeah, shame doesn't grip me like it used to because I'm very aware of it and I'm able to manage it. But I can't say that I don't have it at all anymore.
It's an amazing thing because As you were speaking about yourself and your background and your experience, you know, of your father dying, your marriage, early pregnancy, Tanvir was talking about accusations of plagiarism, his experience on social media and how tough it was. Just being honest and vulnerable allowed me to personally connect with you in a deeper way. Even though we're doing this over Zoom, I don't know who you are, and I just connected with you in a much deeper way. And going back to that earlier sense of Brené Brown's statement that sometimes what shame is feeling unloved or disconnected, it just highlighted to me how powerful vulnerability and the expression of vulnerability is in connecting with people. And, you know, even if we didn't want to do it and we took the view that connection actually is such a driver of happiness, it is a driver of longevity, it's amazing we don't share more of our vulnerability.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Yes. You know, Brené Brown's work on vulnerability and her TED Talk that went viral is all about that. That's really what it's all about. You know, we think historically vulnerability was seen as powerlessness when it's really our power. Mm. And so thank you for that. You know, yeah, I am vulnerable. And we also have to be cautious, you know, of who we share our shame stories with. You know, I there's certain people that aren't safe. And, you know, in this format, as we're trying to get information out, I feel it's important to be vulnerable. But there may be certain situations where we're not. Mm. And I think there's a thing we have to balance out with that as well. Mm.
In your practice, do you think that men are more vulnerable to feeling shame than women? Because they tend to compare themselves more, they're more competitive, or do you feel that the nature of, you know, discrimination, patriarchy makes women more vulnerable to shame?
I think it's just different. I mean, historically, and of course, with all the gender fluidity, things are changing quite a bit. But, you know, historically, it's been men feel shame around not being successful in the workplace and being able to provide for their family. Women feel shame around their body and their parenting looks and things like that. But I think everybody has some element of not feeling lovable, in my experience. And we don't want to talk about it. Like Brené Brown says, you know, not talking about it makes it worse. Everybody has it. Nobody wants to talk about it. And not talking about it makes it worse.
You know, talking about what we don't talk about, often in my work with leaders, I find, and I find this for myself as well, it's easier for me, and I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier for me to know myself and my feelings rather than my impact on others, my social impact on others. And I'm wondering for yourself, maybe we'll start with you, do you ever think about how you've shamed others and the consequence of that rather than you feeling shamed?
Of course, yes. I'm laughing because my daughter, this is probably not exactly what you're asking, but the story that comes to mind is my daughter, who's now 42, I told her, I never said, stop crying before I give you something to cry about. And she said, yes, you did. And I said, no, I didn't. And then I realized she was 9 years old when I started studying with Catherine Kersey, my early childhood mentor. And I probably did. I probably did the old school stuff. I mean, again, my work is really around the parenting aspect. So that's what I gravitate to in your question. And there probably is more other elements. Of course, I've shamed partners that I've, you know, been in relationship with. I've, you know, yes, I have, of course. And then it's always the repair. But I'm technically a kind of a nice person, though. So it's not my nature. I was really lucky. My parents were very kind. You know, they never really, I mean, my mom was very shaming and controlling and you better not do that and stop that. But there was an element of kindness, particularly with my father. So I kind of have that and I'm grateful for that. And so shaming is hard for me to do, but yes, I have done it.
And I, having a psychotherapist on the show, I have to ask you a little bit about one or two upsides of personality disorders. So when I was thinking about it, I thought the only personality disorder I could think of that is avoidant of shame completely are narcissistic personality disorders. Is that right? I mean, do they just dismiss shame completely and immediately? And are they the one grouping of people who do not experience any shame?
Well, I think it's one of the biggest defenses against shame. So all of the behaviors that develop are all just defenses against this unconscious feeling of I'm not lovable. So the narcissist is so defended that they can't even see. And then we'll go into, say, a sociopath, and they have, you know, that lack of conscious.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is, you know, and we have narcissistic personality disorder, and we also have narcissistic traits. So, you know, there's a spectrum of the severity of it, but typically it's the, I'm going to argue with you and make sure that I'm right and you're wrong. And I gaslight you because I feel so badly about myself, but I don't even know it.
So doing a full circle, if I don't feel shame, if I never experience shame, it would be very hard for you to hold me accountable. Let's just take for a moment, and I'm not saying he is, but let's take the view that from some individuals that Donald Trump is a narcissist, and is there any way of ever holding him accountable because he doesn't feel shame, assuming that assumption is correct? Can I ever hold somebody who never experiences shame accountable? Is it just a waste of time and we should just move on?
You know, you're asking such a hard question. I always say I don't talk about politics and religion because I could say a lot about accountability. I mean, he should have been in jail a long time ago. What's the problem there? You know, there's no accountability for all of the things that he has done that are crimes. And we're barely touching the surface. And then now what's going to happen? So I think, yeah, there's accountability for that. But somehow he's not being held accountable. And why is that? You know, but he doesn't, as a human being at this point in his life, I don't know if he would ever feel remorse or a sense of self that we're ideally wanting to create in a better human condition, because he's so rigid in his behaviors and the things that he does, that he's doing.
I see. So Donald Trump came to Patty Ashley, to your practice in Boulder, said, "Patty, I need some help. Where do you start with him?"
I wouldn't.
Why?
I only work with people who want to do the work. Maybe that's where I would say to him is, you know, are you willing, or is this something you're really interested in? Tell me what you see. You know, I'd have to, you know, if he did, which is so hypothetically impossible, but if he did, you know, that would be what I would assess first of all, is this, are you really willing? And if he isn't, he wouldn't be the right fit for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so much, Patty and Tanvir. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's been a pleasure. You too, Patty.
It was fascinating. So thank you.
If you enjoyed the show, we'd love you to leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really goes a long way to helping others discover our conversations. See you soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.